modern times. There is a website called adultery.com. Recently, the founder was interviewed on TV, and he was encouraging people to commit adultery. There is a podcast that you can actually submit anonymously stories of your own adultery so that they can be broadcast on the air so other people can listen in and perhaps get ideas for their own transgressions. Rewind the clock back to the early Middle Ages. There's a young man named Benedict, and he felt that Satan was tempting him with images of a woman, a beautiful woman, and so he didn't want to succumb to that temptation, and so he saw nearby a thorn bush, and so he threw himself into the thorn bush, knowing that the thorns piercing his flesh would be so difficult that they would distract him from the temptation, and so that is what he did. Rewind even further back to the time of Moses, Deuteronomy 22, verse 22, and there we find that if a husband and wife are caught committing adultery, either one of them could be stoned to death. Many people have approached the idea of adultery in different ways through the years. So today we are at this series called The Royal Family Code, The Ten Commandments, and today we arrive at commandment number 7, and as you can guess, it is, you shall not commit adultery. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at that text from Exodus 20, verse 14. Then if you're following along with the Bible, put your finger in Matthew 5, because then we're going to flip over to there, because in the Sermon on the Mount, verses 27 and 30, Jesus actually provides commentary on this same commandment, and so we're going to look at that as well. Then we're going to look at four applications for our lives today. And one of the things we've been finding is that when we go through the commands, we found this through the first six, and we'll find it with the seventh as well, there is more going on here than what first meets the eye. And so some of you coming into a sermon like this as we go through the series, okay, should not commit adultery, okay, maybe that one doesn't apply to me as much. But it is relevant to absolutely everyone. Here are a couple of the reasons why. If you have committed adultery, this will be relevant to you. If you are thinking about it, don't. But this will be relevant to you. If you think, I'd never do that at all in my life, this applies to you, will be relevant to you. If you've ever dealt with lust or sexual temptation, this will be relevant to you. And so before we jump into the text, I just want to provide this reminder of what I said earlier, that we are a hospital for the hurting. We are a schoolhouse for discipleship. And we are an armory for spiritual battle. And so as such, we are an authentic expression of the body of Christ. Are we perfect? No. In fact, if you want a perfect church, you just save you some time, go someplace else, because that's not us. But totally dependent upon the grace of God, we strive to be a schoolhouse for discipleship, hospital for the hurting, armory for spiritual battle. We cannot do that effectively if we don't tell the truth. And so we live in a world where there's so much deception and chaos and hate and confusion and everything else. This is a place where the truth gets told. And we talk about difficult things. So, let's say you've got a doctor, and your doctor withholds critical information for your health. What if you say you're in a criminal case, and your lawyer also withholds information that's critical to your well-being in your case? Are they doing a good job? No. And so it is here. We speak the truth, and we talk about difficult things. Now, how do we do that? Well, Jesus is our model, and Jesus comes, John 1:14, full of grace and truth. And so what is grace? Grace is generosity we don't deserve, but through Christ that God gives to us. Truth is truth. So Jesus comes full of those things, grace and truth. Not grace and no truth, and not truth and no grace, but both. So we seek to speak about even difficult things with grace and truth. Not grace and no truth, not truth and no grace, but both. So let's jump into the first text. Exodus 20, verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. The definition, adultery is sexual intercourse with someone who is married or engaged to another. It's so serious that it is sometimes called the great sin by ancient rabbis and the ancient Jews. The great sin. Now, why is that? Well, a couple of different reasons. Let's focus on it. First of all, many of us have been taught that marriage is a social construct. This is just something that human societies have put together, but it's simply not true. It's not man-made, it's God-made. It is God-ordained. So a husband and wife getting married, having children, this is the biological foundation for a society that propagates itself. Now, does that mean that everyone gets married? No. Some people are called to singleness, and that's great. Paul was single. Jesus was single. Does it mean that everyone has children? No, some people can't, some people don't, some people adopt. There's a whole host of reasons, all of which are fine. But the idea is that this biological union and children, in terms of a society that propagates itself, is at its foundation. And in fact, what happens in the home influences that wider society. So Thomas Cranmer, who is a theologian, he said that really when unfaithfulness in the home, when husbands and wives are not faithful to one another, and that becomes a huge problem that occurs more and more frequently, it is a, quote, poison to the rest of the culture. And so in this sense, healthy homes make a healthier society. Unhealthy homes make a less healthy society. So this is one of the reasons. It's not just about what the privacy of what we do in our homes. It actually has an impact on the society as a whole. Here's another reason. So at the start of the series, we talked about the great command. So these are the Ten Commandments. What's the greatest commandment? And so when Jesus is asked that question in Mark 12, he says, and we know it, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, your neighbor as yourself. One of the things we observed is that the Ten Commandments can be broken into two categories. So 1 to 4, when we live out 1 to 4, that's one of the ways that we show our love and loyalty to God. And when we live out 5 to 10, that's one of the ways we show our love to neighbor, because the first 4 are kind of vertically oriented and the last 6 are horizontally oriented. So when you think about it, a spouse is your closest neighbor. And so cheating on one's spouse is not really a good way to love your closest neighbor. So with that, some high-level information, we're going to skip into our New Testaments to Matthew chapter 5, beginning at verse 27. Recall, this is the well-known Sermon on the Mount. Verse 27, Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And Jesus gets serious real fast about a whole host of things. Now, he says a man looking at a woman, but we know from other passages what he says to men also applies to women. The word lustful, epithymeo, means strong desire or longing. And here it's obviously a sexual context. And so the idea here is that Jesus is pushing the idea deeper. He's saying adultery really is the end result of thoughts that started way over here, thoughts and ideas and stuff in our imaginations and stuff we envision, and oh, maybe this is possible, maybe this isn't things I say and do. Adultery in the end is the sum total of all these other things. So he pushes the issue deeper, going back to the lustful intentions of the heart. And this is what we can't miss. Thoughts are coordinates. Thoughts are coordinates. So what's a coordinate? A coordinate, okay, I want to go somewhere. I type something, some coordinates into my GPS. I type some coordinates into my smartphone, right? And so that's some end destination. And if the coordinates are right, I'll get to the right destination. If the coordinates are wrong, I get to the wrong destination. You know, about once every 2 months, I got to work in a Star Wars reference, so here it is. Imagine, you know, Millennium Falcon, there is Han Solo, Chewbacca, they're in the front, and they're in the ship, and they want to jump into hyperspace. What do they have to do first? They have to type in the coordinates, right? Because if you don't type in the right coordinates, they're going to end up in some asteroid field or sort of some far-flung region in the galaxy, right? The coordinates need to be right. So what Jesus is saying here is this idea, thoughts are coordinates. If we're not careful around the kinds of thoughts that we have in our hearts and minds, we'll end up in the wrong place. This is how serious it is. Verse 29, if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away, for it is better that you lose one of your members, like a part of your body, than that your whole body be thrown into hell. Okay, so that's serious. Whoever said Jesus meek and mild hasn't read the Bible. Your eyes are what you see with. We see people who attract us, maybe think of sexual things. And so he's saying, hey, if that's the case for you, tear out your eye. It was better for you to do it. The pain of doing that will be less than your whole body going to hell. He seems to be saying that at first anyway. Some people have actually taken this literally over time. There was a church father named Origen. And some of these stories are kind of hard to corroborate, so keep that in mind, a little footnote there. But he taught young men and young women about the Christian faith as a church father. And he was so aware of not wanting to succumb to sexual temptation, the story goes that he actually castrated himself. Don't do that. I'm not saying you should do that, but that's how serious he took passages like this. Continuing, verse 30, and if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. Okay, similar idea. We sin with eyes, we sin with hands. The idea is take that bloody stump of your hand, throw it out the window. Compared to the pain of hell, that would be better. So that seems to be what he's saying, but is that what he's literally suggesting we do? No, two reasons. First, he's employing a rabbinic teaching tool, hyperbole, to make a point. Remember hyperbole? Exaggeration for effect. It was a common Jewish rabbinic teaching tool. Second, cutting off a body part doesn't actually deal with the sinful thoughts that you have within. And this is actually Jesus' point. So if he was saying we should literally do this, he would say, hey, cut out your heart. Cut out your mind, because that's really where it originates from. And so Jesus is using extreme language to make an extreme point. We should wage war for the purity of our hearts. That's the point. Now, who goes to hell? It's whoever has unforgiven sin. That's the short answer, right? And so thankfully, Jesus, for what he has done on the cross, total grace, he gives us the gift of peace and forgiveness and eternity with God. So we don't have him, we're on our own. That's a scary prospect. But the point that he's making is extreme. Now, sometimes conservatives and liberals make different but related interpretive mistakes. Conservatives sometimes skip over passages that make them uncomfortable. Liberals water down passages that make them uncomfortable. Both are a problem. Jesus is being very extreme here. We should wage war for the purity of our hearts. Thoughts are coordinates. And so we end our look at the text there. This is the word of the Lord. So as I stated, we're going to apply these teachings to our lives in four ways. First, I'm going to make a very obvious takeaway. Second, an alarming public health emergency. Third, the importance of taking every thought captive to Christ. And fourth, the liberating free grace of Jesus. So first, the obvious takeaway, don't commit adultery. That's the obvious takeaway, okay? If you leave here and you're like, well, I don't know what that was about, this would have been an error, okay? Don't do it. A, God forbids it. B, marriage is the foundation of every human society, biologically speaking. C, healthy marriages bless children. D, healthy homes help society at large. Unhealthy homes tend to hurt society at large. According to the Journal of Marital and Family Therapy, adultery takes place in about 25% of marriages. So if you flip that statistic around, it doesn't occur in 75% of marriages. B plus, yay for us, okay. Second, the alarming public health emergency. And earlier I said that we speak the truth and we talk about difficult things. Jesus raises the issue of lust, and we live in a time of unprecedented access to pornography. Don't be naive about what is happening around us. When people over 50 think of pornography, they think, okay, something in a Playboy magazine. They think about going into a video store, maybe downloading something from online. But today, pornography is more easily accessible than at any other time in human history. Plus, pornography is becoming more violent. It is luring people younger and younger, and they are designing it in such a way to promote addiction, especially in young people. In our increasingly illicit culture, it is virtually impossible to not experience some level of sexual temptation, myself included. It's a war zone out there. The three major pornography websites have 5.81 billion visits a month. 5.81 billion visits a month. Pornhub is the most used adult-only website in the world. And guess what? It's a Canadian company housed in Montreal. During the pandemic, hey, stay at home, 24% increase in pornography usage. In America, and I assume that the same thing is true in Canada, the biggest pornography consumer age demographic is between 12 and 17. One in five teenage girls have posted nude or semi-nude pics online. Last month, the New York Times published an expose that you should all have heard about, but probably none of you did, or the vast majority of you didn't, because we've got a truth problem in this country. Here it is. Pornhub's own internal documents revealed it has knowingly hosted and profited from videos of children suffering from non-consensual sex acts and made money off of them. Should have been public outcry, crickets. Dr. Norm Doidge, a psychiatrist and New York Times bestselling author of The Brain That Changes Itself, explains this. Pornography satisfies every one of the prerequisites for neuroplastic change. When pornographers boast that they are pushing the envelope by introducing new, harder themes, what they don't say is that they must, because their customers are building up a tolerance to the content. In America, pornography consumption rivals, in terms of the money made, it rivals iTunes digital merchandise sales. It rivals the money made from the U.S. water, bottled water industry. Canada ranks 7th in the world for visits to Pornhub alone. The average Canadian spends 10 minutes a day on Pornhub, not to mention other websites and videos. According to the Association of Reform Political Action, pornography consumption in Canada can easily be described as a public health issue. Why? Scientific studies have associated watching pornography with increased loneliness, anxiety, poor overall mental health, increased sexual aggression, dissatisfaction with romantic relationships. We're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. It's a war zone. Third, the importance of taking every thought captive to Christ. In light of some of the things we've been talking about, in 2 Corinthians 10:5, Paul says we should take every thought captive to Christ. He's acknowledging that we are engaged in a battle for the mind and multiple levels. Why? Because thoughts are coordinates. And so what are we spending our time thinking about? What are we focusing our brains on? Are we thinking about things, cultivating a thought life, habits in our life that are directing us toward the grace and truth of Jesus or away from the grace and truth of Jesus? There's this really interesting the experiment that was done. So they took this piano student and they hooked up kind of these attachments to their head to observe their, you know, brain activity. And there's a piano in front of them that said, hey, imagine playing a song. And so the students sat there and imagined playing a song. And when they did, there all these kind of lights and electrodes went up on certain parts of the brain. They said, okay, now play the song. Actually go up to the piano and play the song. And when they did so, the same parts of the brain started to become active. Now, does that mean that imagining something and playing something are the same? No. It's not. Clearly one is worse than the other. But at the same time, they're not unrelated. What we think about actually changes our brain. In The Cost of Discipleship, the martyred German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer said this, "Adherence to Jesus allows no free rein to desire unless it be accompanied by love." And so that's the idea. So all our relationships should be loving. We want to reflect the love of Christ. So all people, regardless of background, are made in the image of God. Genesis 1:27 says it. Made in the image of God. Therefore, they are due respect and love because they are made in the image of their Creator. And so if there's anything we're thinking or doing that doesn't honor that image in other people, there's the issue. So this is why we have to engage in a war about our thought life. Thoughts are coordinates. And it's not just about what we don't look at, but what we do look at in the battle for the mind. So today I just want to highlight two resources to help, and I'll put them up here on the screen. The first is a book. Some of you haven't thought about this before. It's called The Porn Problem by Vaughn Roberts. I've read it. It's a couple of years old, but the stuff is still relevant. It's only 80 pages, so it's not long. It explains kind of some of the big picture trends, not just theologically, but scientifically. And it also talks about, hey, maybe someone here is struggling with it. Maybe you know someone who is. This can be a help. And the second is a website called Fight the New Drug. It's not religious in nature, but this website, it has scientific studies, has personal testimonies, doctors' quotes, everything else, downloadables. This is about helping people or teens, older people, older adults, whoever happens to be struggling with these things to resource themselves. Fourth and finally, the liberating free grace of Jesus. And this is where we need to end today. There are people here who have struggled with this in the past. There are people here who have struggled with some of these things in the present. And there are people who will listen to this message now, or they'll watch the video or listen to the podcast after the fact, and they will feel guilty or they will feel shame. They will feel like it's just too big of a mountain to climb. Maybe it's addiction. Maybe it's not quite at that place yet. To those people, let me say a few things. Your sin does not define you. We as the people of God are not defined by our sin. Last week I shared a quote from a young missionary named Bryce Crawford, and he said, "Satan knew me by my name but called me by my sin. Jesus knew my sin but called me by my name." And I love that. That's such a powerful way to put it. He calls us by, he knows all the things about us, but he calls us by our name. We can become so consumed with what we think Satan can do to us that we forget what God can do for us. Because with Christ, all things are actually possible. And the story of God's liberating free grace of Jesus is told beautifully and powerfully, I think, in the story of the woman caught in adultery. You know it. So basically, this woman's been caught in the act. How that looked, I don't know. She gets caught in the act. She gets brought before Jesus. There's all these people surrounding her. Jesus, teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says that we can stone her. What should we do? They're testing Jesus. And they've got these stones. And so Jesus bends down and he writes something in the sand. We're not told what he writes. He gets up and he says, "Let him who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And so they start to leave one by one, beginning with the older ones. They start to leave one by one. Jesus bends down. He writes in the sand a second time. Again, we don't know what he wrote. And then he asks the woman, "Has no one remained to condemn you?" And she says, "No one, Lord." And he says, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and leave your life of sin." Notice how grace and truth. "Neither do I condemn you, but go and leave your life of sin." Now, at the start of this sermon, I put a stone on this stool, and perhaps you're wondering why I did that. This is about the size of a stone that would have been used in public stonings, because it's got to be small enough to hold and throw, but big enough to do damage to a human skull. So think of a stone about this size. But what I'd like you to think about is, in this story, pretend, for those who struggle with some of these things, I want you to imagine that it's not a woman caught in adultery, but that it's you. But that it's you, actually, and people have brought you and accused you before the Lord. This is what he is doing. And so what I'd like you to imagine, you're standing there, and there's maybe not physical people with voices saying things. Maybe there are voices in your head. "You don't love God. You're not a believer. You know that's sin. Why don't you ask for forgiveness? You know you're going to do it again. A perfect God would never forgive you." These are the kinds of voices that circle around in our heads. And then imagine Jesus coming up, not to the woman, but you, and he comes up, and he bends down, and he writes something in the sand. And as the story says, we don't know what he wrote. Maybe he wrote the sign of the cross and encouraged you to look at it. "Look, I died for you." Maybe he made the sign of a heart just to communicate his love. Maybe he wrote your name. Maybe he wrote your name because Satan calls you by your sin, but Christ calls you by your name. Maybe that's what he is doing. It's interesting because Jesus says, "Anyone who is without sin be the first to cast a stone." I guess who the only person in the room was who fit those qualifications? Jesus. The Bible says he was without sin, Hebrews 4:15. He actually could have been within his right to throw the stone at the woman. He could be within his right to throw the stone at us, but he doesn't. And what he said to her, he says to us, "Neither do I condemn you, but go and leave your life of sin." A couple of years ago, I interviewed someone who was coming out of a pornography addiction for the blog, and this is what he said. "Satan wants you to think that you're the only one with the problem, but you are not alone. And so, friends, not only do you have supportive people who love you and who want good things for you, but you have resources to help, and you have the help and the liberating free grace of Jesus. The free, forgiving grace of Christ has the power to change lives, not just on the outside, but on the inside." Friends, thoughts are coordinates, so let's take every thought captive to Christ as we strive to live out our royal pedigree. He is Lord, and he will provide free, redeeming grace for his glory and for the healing of every human heart. Amen.